Welcome to Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that does occasionally experiment with editing, but only to make minor alterations. I'm Alex Andreu, fresh from sweeping at the Oscars. It only took me a couple of hours. And just Senna's pants should fetch a tidy sum on eBay. On today's show, Lee Anderson defects to the Reform Party and vows to take his country back. From whom is unclear. Plus, instead of being a turning point for the better, Jeremy Hunt's budget seems to have made polling figures worse for the government. We look at the fallout. Let's meet the panel. First up, it's Guardian columnist Raphael Baer, whose splendid book, Politics: A Survivor's Guide, is out on paperback this week for non-elites who buy such things. Hello, Raph.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Last week was pretty packed with US election news. Super Tuesday's out of the way. Nikki Haley has dropped out. Biden delivered a punchy State of the Union. And Trump seems to think he can crowdfund half a billion's worth of damages, $5 at a time. What stands out to you?
Well, it's fascinating how we're still sort of reporting on this or analysing it as if it were a normal election. That's the bit that I still find extraordinary. Because you go back, you know, you'd have thought that we'd have learned this lesson from 2016, that these are not equivalent candidacies and equivalent campaigns. And, you know, I can get sucked into the sort of cephalogical breakdown, you know, that Nikki Haley's voters might help swing it for Biden, but then there's these third party candidates that might, you know, fragment the Democratic vote and let Trump in. But actually, you know, that's the wrong frame, because, you know, if you can see a trajectory of a meteorite coming from space about to hit the Earth, you don't sort of analyze the chemical composition of the meteorite. You think, what are we going to do about the meteorite? As I say, we haven't learned a lesson from 2016. We haven't sort of, or at least American media doesn't seem to have adapted to the idiom of one of these candidates actually threatens the integrity of the US Republic and the other one doesn't. And therefore you frame it differently. And that to me seems to be like, it shouldn't be close. That's the point I'm trying to make.
So your answer is Bruce Willis.
Yeah. That's, I think it basically, how is it even a thing that we're talking about in these terms?
And yet there it is. Ros Taylor is a Bunker and Oh God, What Now? Mainstay and author of the recently published The Future of Trust. Hi, Ros.
Hello, Alex.
Last week, Michelle Donnellan had to apologise to an academic she wrongly accused of being a Hamas supporter. And we also found out that a £15,000 settlement was paid out of public money. How is any of this okay and Donnellan still in post?
It's not okay, of course. I mean, it shows massively poor judgment. And it's basically Michelle Donnellan was just trying to make a cheap culture war point, and she ended up getting herself into very big legal
and
trouble.
And ended up making an expensive culture war point.
Yes. But there are two sort of interpretations as to why Sunak is not cracked down on this. And one is that he genuinely thinks 15K is neither here nor there. It's just peanuts in the broad scheme of things. And of course, for Rishi Sunak, it probably is. Mm-hmm. But it's also not a tiny sum of money. Or it is very important that Michelle Donnellan not be seen to have screwed up, which is why I suspect a succession of ministers, including Penny Mordaunt, have been sent in recent days to defend what she did and describe her as an excellent minister and so on. But neither explanation is particularly edifying.
Mm. Penny Mordaunt's was particularly hilarious, I thought. She pointed out she hadn't taken her ministerial severance pay, which was 16K. So really, it's a wash.
After she had served for 36 hours?
I know. Yeah. Finally, Hannah Fearn is a reporter and columnist who focuses on social affairs. Hey, Hannah.
Hi.
Several councils have gone bankrupt. And in a recent survey, nearly half of all councillors accept their local authority to join that group in the next 5 years. Ministers blame mismanagement. Labour says they won't bail them out if elected. But, I mean, is that just a strategic miscalculation by both parties?
Well, first of all, it's easy to say mismanagement because it just passes the buck, but it's absolutely not mismanagement. It's a result of catastrophic underfunding and cuts over decades. This is a situation where I think some councils like Eastbourne, 49p in every pound taken in council tax is going on statutory obligations like providing emergency accommodation for homeless people. So if you've got that legal responsibility, what can you do except fulfil it? But if you haven't got the money to do it, that's the situation you end up in. So no, it's not mismanagement. Reeves says she's not going to bail them out. Well, I mean, reality is she is going to bail them out. It's just not going to be called a bailout, because a bailout suggests chaos and jumping in to fill a gap that you then change nothing, so the gap keeps opening up. What it will be a bailout called something like the New Labour Deal for Communities, which, you know, repositions council funding as a completely different kind of package. And
or maybe integrate social care into the NHS.
We don't know what yet, because we haven't seen the manifesto, what they're actually going to do, but the bailout will, the money will be there. It just won't be called a bailout. It'll be called a new policy.
It just strikes me that, like, local government is the vast majority of people's direct contact with the state. And when people say nothing works anymore, like, letting local government go to pot seems to me a really bad electoral decision by the Conservatives. Will people distinguish? Will they say, oh, the government is marvellous, it's my local council that is screwing up? Or will they just see decay?
Actually, funnily enough, I think specifically for the Tories, the worst underfunding and the kind of most tangible effects are felt in the big Labour-run cities. And I think sometimes people do blame their council and they do blame the party of local government because they know that it's, say, Labour-run. So I think there is a possibility of passing the buck again there.
We'll get him in singles, Wilfred. That's what legendary all-rounder George Hurst is said to have muttered to his last wicket partner at the Oval in 1902. Well, the Tories started this parliament with a numerical majority of 80. It is now 46. Lee Anderson, continuing his Pokemon approach to political parties, got to catch them all, announced today, Monday, that he's joining the fully owned Farage Limited company that is Reform UK. He said it is what his friends, his family and his constituents wanted, adding, and some of my donors. Roz, is this a coup for Reform, or is making a loose-lipped troublemaker their foremost spokesperson likely to backfire?
Well, it's a mini coup. I mean, they've got an MP in the House of Commons now, which is good news for them. I can't say I was bowled over when the GB News correspondent, obviously, announced it today, since GB News is the in-house broadcasting channel of the Reform Party. Yes, he seems
kept
to.
Saying
amazing.
A source within the Reform Party. I can't think who it might be.
Yeah. The question, I think, is sort of two questions. Is it likely that Lee Anderson is going to in any way undermine Reform's party line in the way that he has tried to undermine the Conservatives' party line? And the answer to that is no, because Reform doesn't really have set party lines or anything like a coherent manifesto. You know, it's all about fundamentally Nigel Farage, even though he's currently in the background. And it's about getting people angry with the Tories' failures. So then the second question is, will Lee Anderson's plain speaking shtick get any attention when he's not actually in the Conservatives anymore? Or will he just look like a kind of, you know, I would say pound shop, but actually 30p Nigel Farage? The risk is that when your outrageousness stops looking so outrageous, when there's outrage all around you, right, he just might not stand out as much anymore. And that might be bad for him and rather pointless for the Reform Party. But obviously, it does show up the poor judgment of Rishi Sunak in having made him chair the first place.
I loved a bit about his parents telling him they couldn't vote for him, apparently. I just thought that was such a nice little piece of the Lee Anderson puzzle. He recently signed a motion, Roz, calling for anyone defecting from one party to another to trigger an automatic by-election. He seems a lot less keen on that idea now. Is the proximity of a general election a reasonable excuse?
Well, it's certainly an excuse he's using. I'm not sure if it's reasonable. It's intensely hypocritical, but I think what he doesn't want is to have a by-election and for Labour to win it. That would take all the momentum out of Reform, which currently, as we've observed in the past, is gradually ticking up in the polls and has now overtaken the Lib Dems, which should frankly worry the Lib Dems a lot. But that is the main risk that he would be taking. But I think there's another interest, which is to save Reform money that they can then plough into fighting the general election.
He said that quite explicitly, didn't he? He said basically by-elections are pretty expensive.
Yeah, they're extremely. Yeah, you don't want to throw that away. You'd rather save it for, allow the momentum they hope to build up until the autumn, they hope, and spend that money on getting him re-elected and getting some other target seats elected.
Hannah, I think it's fair to say that Lee Anderson has been on a political journey. He reacted very angrily to journalist Beth Rigby, who pointed this journey out. He said, country, constituency, then party, next question. Does he have a point? Should party allegiances be much looser?
I think he might feel that they go in that order, but I think that makes him sort of slightly divorced from the electorate, who I think would say country and party, followed by constituency, but in a general election, because when we, our system, our first-past-the-post system, which always elects both a dominant party and a strong opposition, usually, it's designed to deliver that, and it creates that kind of factionalism in our politics. And so I don't think that his analysis bears any relationship to how people choose to vote. But so I don't think you can pull that one out. I don't think it works. And I think he said before, as we were just discussing, that there should be a by-election if somebody switches. And I think for that reason, I agree with him, his original analysis, that you must hold a by-election because people do vote for a party in a general election.
Tory MP Mark Pritchard says that hopefully one day he will come back to the Conservative Party and pointed out that Churchill changed parties several times.
Spectre of Churchill rides in.
To listeners not watching this on YouTube, can I just tell you that Raf deployed the biggest eye roll I have ever seen. Body eye roll.
I think I've actually strained my eyes off it. It's just because the mention of deploying Churchill, that's the end of it. And it was in Godwin's Law, you know,
it's
where
like Godwin's Law, yeah.
It's a special UK-specific parochial version of Godwin's Law. But once you've tried to compare yourself to Churchill...
It was the interpretive dance equivalent to an eye roll. What do you think of that, Hannah? Is there really a way back for him?
It depends what happens to the Tories after their wipeout, doesn't it? If they choose to, you know, actually do something sensible and tank to the centre and rebuild themselves as a proper party of opposition, then no, there is no way back in the short term. If they choose to radicalise further to the far right, then yes, I'm sure he'll find a home back within them. But let's hope that isn't, you know, the way it goes.
Mm. Christopher Hope reports that sources close to Reform, I mean, that presumably is like a bottle of ketchup in the GB News canteen under which Richard leaves him notes. Sources close to Reform say it is in talks with as many as 9 more Tory MPs.
As many as nine.
I know, which I love, right? Anyway, as many as 9 more Tory MPs they're talking to. Do you think this is the start of a drip drip? Will we see more defections?
No, I don't think we'll see many. I think it's important not to overstate the case of their influence. I know Roz was just saying that she feels that it's a real issue that they're polling equal or above the Lib Dems. But if you look at Douglas Carswell and Mark Reckless, they defected and then it really did nothing for the UKIP cause.
And talking up the numbers is just a way of spooking the Tories. Yeah. I mean, there's an obvious interest in inflating that and actually Reform's performance in by-elections. When voters have actually been asked out to demonstrate what they want to do, they underperform their headline polling. I actually agree. I think they shouldn't be underestimated, but I'm still waiting for clear cephalological evidence that they can actually deliver at the ballot box.
Mm. Raf, we might have been talking about a relatively unknown backbencher today. As Roz pointed out, can the magnitude of this story be laid partly on the feet of Sunak for making Anderson deputy party chair?
I think yes, because you know it is a symptom of something we've discussed before, which is that he has he's very clumsy, clunky tactical judgment and doesn't really seem to be able to think strategically around corners. I mean, it was sort of so obvious to think, well, somehow I, Rishi Sunak, former banker, maybe perceived as being a bit of part of the global metropolitan elite, needs an ensign, needs someone who could sort of represent working class Toryism, and so I'll get the kind of the cartoon figure who represents that, Lee Anderson, without thinking that you've then sort of made your judgment and your reputation for seriousness and integrity a hostage to him of all people. And absolutely, you know, Roz's point I think was very well made, that as long as he has that status as a former deputy chair of the Conservative Party and a Conservative MP and they're the governing party, what he says and the mischief he might make, you know, has a certain salience, you know, now that he's actually made the leap and gone to Reform, he might be a bit disappointed at how irrelevant he is. We might be wrong about that, but I think that that's certainly a risk for him. I think there is something else though, which is in the age of, you know, social media age, in now that GB News is there, as we've discussed before, carving out this particular niche for itself as a sort of Fox News wannabe for the UK right, you can have a career in politics just doing that kind of performative thing outside the chamber of the House of Commons, not really being an interesting legislator, not really saying anything interesting, but as I say, being a cartoon character. So in a sense, he's also a symptom of something that's changed in the media landscape.
Yeah. Although I have to say, I think there's a limited capacity for that. Like, if you get a new one coming in being outrageous, they dislodge some other.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think he's very good at it. I think actually it would be quite easy for someone, for whoever the next Lee Anderson is, to come along and just basically do that better and for people to pay a bit less attention to him.
I mean, I think they always existed. They used to be called rent-a-gobs. It's just that when you're reading the newspaper, you don't spot the faces so visibly. And now we're very broadcast and, you know, clips on social media led. Yeah. It's the same face coming round and round. And yes, they get replaced, but there's always a face.
Conventional wisdom is that reform splits the right-wing vote. Champagne corks popping at Labour HQ over this. But is there a scenario in which reform actually takes just as many Labour votes in former so-called red wall seats? Is that what they're targeting with this acquisition?
I think they'd like to think so. And that's certainly the message that they're delivering. And it's sort of, you know, that there's no difference. Labour Tories, all the same, come over to reform. The reality is that while demographically that sort of ought to be true in theory of people who used to vote Labour, the particular damage was done there already by Brexit and already in 2019. So the segment that reform are fishing in, the pool of voters they're attracting, are actually people who have already left Labour. Some of them have gone back to Labour, but then there's a whole bunch more who's saying they don't know. Now, essentially, you know, Labour's current polling strength doesn't really need too many more of them. They'd like to get more of them, but the ones they're getting have gone back to Labour. So actually, the contest is between the Tories and reform over sort of pre-2019 ex-Labour don't knows, if you see what I mean. It is asymmetric. It's a massive, way, way bigger problem for the Tories.
And Ashfield, I mean, I would advise listeners to go and have a look at Ashfield as a seat. It is genuinely a very unusual seat and one whose boundaries are changing. Hannah, Sadiq Khan made a statement on this, pointing out that the Tory leadership and many MPs refused to condemn Anderson's comments as anti-Muslim hate or Islamophobic. And now they find themselves on that hill for nothing. Is there a danger, actually, that the Tories and Reform will now join a race to the bottom, ignoring the part of the bell curve that, as Paul Scully pointed out, contains actually the most votes in the middle?
Yeah, I think so. First of all, I don't think that those that didn't come forward and declare this as, you know, Islamophobic or make a strong statement on it in the Tory party were actually hanging out for Anderson. I think that they genuinely believe, whatever their personal views, that many of their constituents are in agreement, possibly largely because of ignorance. So there is a constituent of people outside London who really believe that within London there are these sort of no-go zones and so on. That's not that they just don't know they're not here.
And there's a lot of people in London who believe those people exist out of London.
Also true. So I think this is the danger of chasing votes, mythological votes or real votes. Rather than having guiding principles. Where a race to a bottom exists, it exists in that sense, that it's about people no longer caring about what they went into politics for and what they really believe, but about this chasing game. When you look at the kind of the debate over the definition of extremism, that's why this is so at such a dangerous issue and such a dangerous time to be having that debate, because there is this lack of sort of principle among a certain number of elected politicians at the moment.
Yeah. Ros, looking at that precise issue, but slightly more macro, is this an existential threat to the Tories beyond the next election, or might it actually push them back towards the centre if there is this alternative thing actually that is fishing more successfully in that small pond?
Paradoxically, I think it might do both. Because I don't think it's entirely impossible that reform could do very well at the next general election. I don't think it's likely. I've advanced this opinion on social media last week or the week before, and I was roundly trashed by a number of blokes, and that's fine. But I actually think they underestimate the appeal of a party like Reform at an election when the Conservatives are likely to do extremely badly and Labour looks like a shoo-in. And when people may not feel that they have to get out the Labour vote in order to get rid of the Conservatives, and they may not feel that, they may feel quite free to vote for another party that expresses their anger with the Conservatives better, as they see it. And that party could well be Reform. Now, I think Reform has some crucial weaknesses compared to some far-right parties in Europe. It hasn't modernised itself. It's a party of grumpy, older blokes. Increasingly, the European far right is making itself look younger and more dynamic.
And more left-wing on economics as well. Yes, that's the key thing. Reform's big problem, I think, is that they're still essentially sort of Baroque, Thatcherite, libertarian right on economics. And actually, what a lot of the clever far right in continental Europe are doing is tacking populist left on capitalism and big business.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if Reform can really plough its efforts into a few constituencies, George Galloway style, and really try to make to push them, they could even end up being the official opposition. I don't think it's likely, but I think it's entirely possible.
There is a mathematical possibility.
There is a mathematical possibility. We shouldn't write that off and underestimate them because we want to.
I mean, obviously, you never say never, and I do understand the volatility underneath all of this. I do think, though, just in terms of organization, candidates, the sorts of things you really need to fight 650 constituency contests. I mean, they wouldn't do all 650. Yeah, they're not going to do very well in Scotland, for example. But you know what I mean? I don't think they're big enough to really be that kind of threat at the general election.
I get it. I get that completely. I'm just saying that one of the things that sticks in my head in polling analysis of 2019 Conservative voters is that there's a 25% who plan to vote Conservatives, but that quarter still thinks the Conservatives deserve to lose the next election. And I think there is that big slice of people who...
Yeah, it could flip.
You know, who think the Conservatives deserve a kicking, basically.
And I do think the kicking thing is interesting. Ros is right to point out the Labour voters who might feel that they don't need to be there for Labour at that point, because actually that's part of the issue with the Brexit vote, was that there were people who felt like they're giving the establishment a kicking for not being listened to. And people weren't, you know, sufficiently aware that that was a force in that vote until it was too late.
And it depends if they can harness the immigration issue as well. That will be very important to them. So far, small boats are at the same level as last year. If net migration continues high, they will seize upon that.
It's one reason possibly for, I don't think Rishi Sunak should or would go for an election in May. I wish he would, but I don't think it's in his interests to do it, except for the possibility of a summer of small boat crossings. Yeah, that's one thing. He might want to just go to the country before that even happens.
And disintegration in his party. Raph, there's a school of thought that the Conservative Party promised a referendum and then pushed Brexit through in order to prevent precisely this unravelling. Does this period reveal that the driver was not actually Euroscepticism, but something a little bit deeper, some much more profound dysfunction?
I think essentially yes is the answer. And we mentioned before, you know, some of those UKIP defections from the Conservative Party. You know, it's very interesting when you remember that period when David Cameron promised a referendum and he was under pressure. There are all sorts of reasons why the Conservative right was angry, partly because of the Lib Dems were in coalition and Lib Dem, you know, MPs were getting ministerial jobs that a bunch of angry old white Tories felt was their entitlement after all the years of opposition. But other things, you know, gay marriage was still, you know, something that UKIP activists and UKIP parties were getting angry about, even though that's now a completely settled matter. There was a wider swirl on the right of things that created the grievance that could then, and you see that now because it attaches itself to net zero or whatever other sort of radical right-wing
cities, 15-minute cities, whatever.
And then more broadly, the sort of genius of the way the Brexit vote did mobilise a sense of giving the entire establishment a kicking, and sort of Brexitism as a sort of populist movement in the UK with a nationalist core, delivering it is this thing called Brexit, which they couldn't do, and was sort of giving antibiotics for a viral infection. It was never actually going to cure the underlying problem. And so you get into the business of blame and finding reasons why it hasn't worked.
It's interesting that you mention that, because actually one of my favorite bits in your book, out now on paperback, is where you say, and I paraphrase, but only a little bit, that the difference between sort of patriotism and nationalism is that one involves a love of country and a romanticization of the past. The other involves a promise to return to that past. And is that basically the battle we're seeing at the moment? That there are people who genuinely believe that there is some 50s green and pleasant land to which we could return.
Yeah, it's mobilizing an idea of the past as a prescription for the future. But also the key distinction and the defining feature of nationalism is that it asserts as a political discipline the idea that a certain group of people get to define what the qualities of the nation are. So if you're a patriot, you can love all sorts of things about your country. It's food, it's sense of humor, it's music. But as a nationalist, you look to a political prospectus as your definition of what makes the country great. And then you enforce that. And if you disagree with that, you basically forfeit your right to be part of the nation, one of the people. That was absolutely central to the way the case for Brexit was made. Brexit was never going to satisfy the people who voted for it, and therefore that core has to attach itself to a set of other prescriptions.
Next up, time to choose our hero and villain of the week. Who is Messy the dog and who is just a dog mess? Raf.
So my hero is going to be John Boucher. He was a former chief constable of Bedfordshire Police, but then latterly of the Police Service of Northern Ireland. And he ran the inquiry into the background to the case of the man we must know as Steak Knife, who was an extremely highly placed agent for British security services, working in one of the most ferocious, murderous bits of the IRA. It's an incredibly complicated story, and ultimately, we know an awful lot about a very murky, dark business, and some extraordinary facts have come out. Now, this guy, Steak Knife, the person who most people think it was, who it almost certainly was, has died, so he'll never face justice. But had it not been for John Boucher just really getting the bit between his teeth and just deciding he was going to get facts out of MI5, he was going to get facts out of, special branch, out of the police, he was just going to go, like an old school copper, go after the facts. And he did it, and I'm very grateful that he did.
And your villain?
My villain, I'm afraid it's slightly cheating because it's going back to a topic we had a moment ago, but we haven't really talked about Richard Tice. And I've got a very specific reason for just being angry with Richard Tice. I watched that press conference that he did with Lee Anderson, and he said one thing that really made my blood boil, which was when he talked about the concerns of the Jewish community about this thing they always talk about, which is the extremism being everywhere, and in defense of Lee Anderson's comments about Sadiq Khan. And I sit there, I'm British Jewish, and I sit there watching Tice say that, and I think, get the name of my people out of your mouth, Richard Tice. It's not an ally British Jews want. And on top of that, it's such a tell, he said, there are even British Jews who are so scared they're thinking of going back to Israel. Back to Israel?
Oh my God.
What? I mean... Well, yeah, okay. You just sort of... Wow. fantastic reveal.
It's like, veil
whole
lifted.
Section where he...
It's the back. It's like there contained is the far-right trope that actually, even when he claims to be defending Jews, he still basically thinks we're aliens who don't really
You're
belong
all
here.
Israelis, really, on some level.
Okay,
how about you, Rose?
My hero is David Neil. He was the border watchdog who was sacked by the Home Secretary.
David Neil. Yeah. Love his work.
He basically embarrassed the Home Office by pointing out all the things that they were screwing up in border management. And he keeps doing so and giving more interviews. And it's having an effect, because when he was sacked, I think there were 15 reports that he'd written that the Home Office refused to publish. And now there are only 2 which are not yet in the public domain. Yeah. And it's been very effective.
Yeah. How about your villain?
I won't go political this week. I think it's anyone grifting on social media to demand a picture of Kate Middleton, or the Princess of Wales, as I believe you know, we call her. I mean, either you want a royal family or you don't. If you want a royal family...
I don't either.
But if you want one, you have to play your part in preserving the mystique of the royal family. And when the royal family say, well, this person is ill and they're recovering and they're not going to be in the public eye for 3 months, then you have to accept that. And you can't just turn around and say, we want a picture of a sick person to prove she's not dead.
Okay, all right. I would push back very gently by saying that that goes both ways. Mm-hmm. Like, if they want to preserve the mystique, then don't put out photos where people have three legs.
Well, that's... I mean... that is the point. But, I mean, you push... We all know that the royal family is a tissue of, you know, a fiction. And if we're going to keep up that pretense, and if we're going to keep up that fiction, we have to have respect for the whole, the fact that it is mostly invented,
yeah,
and not push so far that we end up destroying it. You know, it's that sort of Oscar Wilde killing things we love, and that's what they're doing.
Okay.
Well, I've got a related hero.
Okay.
My hero is, or heroes are the picture agencies for not just giving in to this, you know, fiction of the royal family and thinking, oh, well, we'll let this go because it doesn't really matter. Who cares where Kate is? And let's just put this one through because it's a nonsense. Actually, they knew it would cause an almighty fuss to kill it and to do that public statement about killing it. But it really, really matters. I've seen a lot of chat on social media about, well, you know, why is everybody creating such a fuss? They should just let Kate have her peace. That's true. But it's really important that the picture agencies preserve our right to understand the pictorial truth, yes, as it stands. And the fact that they haven't just rolled over because it's the silly, you know, nothing that is the royal family, I think is a really pleasing thing.
I mean, if something has the hallmarks of a fake, then
they have
that's
to stand
that.
Up. Yeah, exactly.
And your villain?
My villain is the Department of Defence Security and Tom Tugendhat specifically, maybe, if we're going to put a name on it. But
we're talking about Tom in a minute.
The budget for the London Prevent programme has been slashed. And that means that currently no borough in South London at all will get any Home Office funding for counter-extremism, counter-terror. And this is when we've had Sunak standing up on the steps of Downing Street talking about extreme views, talking about these perspectives and how they destroy our communities, and yet the funding has all been pulled for that sort of preventative work. So that's my villain of the week.
Right. So I'm going to go for Tom Tugendhat because I didn't know about that, the funding for Prevent being pulled. And I think it's outrageous. So I'm going to give him the prominence of villain of the week to amplify that story. And I'm going to go for John Boucher because you just sold it very well, Raph. And I would offer a hero of my own this week very, very quickly. There are 57 people who have signed a letter to the government who are either have lost relatives or lost limbs to terror attacks, writing a letter to the government basically saying, not in our name. We're not going to let you conflate an entire community in this country with terrorists just because it plays well for you politically. Last week, Jeremy Hunt's budget joined a tall trash heap of events designed to be a turning point to variably reset this government, relaunch this government, refresh this government, resuscitate this government. That did nothing of the sort, leaving many to wonder whether we may need to bury this government now as the weather gets warmer before it starts to smell a bit. And the two polls that have tested opinion since then both show the Tories 2 points down since before the budget. Hannah, did the way everything was briefed out in advance affect perception of the event? Even government-friendly media outlets seem to have been left thinking, is that it? Because they were expecting some kind of surprise that didn't come.
Actually, I think the problem wasn't just the content, although pre-briefing does, you know, take the excitement out of it. It was also the tedious delivery. I've never seen such a rubbish fiscal event, or whatever you want to call it. You know, it failed to make any kind of overarching message. Really bad presentation. And also Hunt kept plumping for all those repetitive jokes about the opposition, which was just paused him all the way through and stopped him creating.
I mean, some of them were downright naff.
Yeah, just dire, really tedious. So I think that was part of the issue, almost more than the pre-briefing. I think the majority of people don't digest it in that level of detail, so I don't think the pre-briefing matters as much as we might
think. Yeah, but I think they digest the general media reaction, which was a little bit like, huh.
Yeah, exactly. There was definitely a slight kind of shrug, like a meh about
also, by
it.
Convention, you're supposed to give this news to the House of Commons. I mean, you aren't. I mean, it's not that long ago, really. I mean, you're not talking about like 1950s. Only a few years ago, it would have been considered really quite bad form for significant budget measures to be out before the Chancellor.
I get
up.
That, Rav. I'm with you. But then Liz Truss happened and it's now become like a massive anxiety to think, oh my God, the city basically
no
must
surprises,
know
no
every
surprises,
single
yeah.
thing in the budget before it's out. There has been, as I mentioned, been some polling to gauge reaction, and some of it went a little bit in depth. What is it showing?
Actually, it found that twice as many voters think it will lead to a tax rise rather than those that will think it will lead to a cut. And that's interesting because actually for the vast majority of people, it will be a tax cut. Maybe not significant, but a minor one, but it will be a small cut. But actually, due to the threshold freezes at the point at which you start to pay tax, for the wealthiest, it will probably be a bit of a rise. And you know, maybe they're a bit more vocal
not
about it.
Not just for the wealthy. There are weird pockets.
The middle, maybe,
there
as well.
There are weird pockets of people who do well and weird pockets of people who don't do well. Basically, everyone near the thresholds does really badly because inflation pushes them just above it.
But the interesting thing is that the majority of people will still experience a small cut, and yet we're still talking about it potentially being a rise because those who are affected are incredibly vocal about it. So Hunt has completely failed to make that case. Well, as you said as well, the drop in voting intention post this budget means that it's now down to Truss levels of popularity.
And Hunt's approval
and Adair,
went
basically.
Down as well.
Yeah.
Raf, in part, I think, because of the underwhelming response to the statement itself, media proxies and Treasury ministers exaggerated the elimination of national insurance altogether as if it were some sort of pledge, a position from which Hunt had to resile the next day, calling it just an aspiration. Is there a strategy there?
I wouldn't dignify it with the word strategy, but I do think there is something deliberate about it. And
there is a malevolent intelligence.
No, it's not even malevolent. I think it's, you know, it's, as I've said before, I think it's just like the bad chess player who goes, oh, look, you know, queen to, you know, d4, check. Oh, your knight just took my queen. Why didn't I see that coming? It's not that hard, actually, but they just do these clunky things. And I think actually what we're seeing here is a tension between, you know, within the Conservative Party and actually within Downing Street and between the Treasury and between Number 10 and probably people within Number 10, where, you know, actually at some level, if your working assumption is we've lost the election, you have sort of two options, really. One is to think, what might my sort of footnote in history be? What might the sort of the chapter that's written about my time say? And is it possible to salvage something along the lines of, well, they were caretakers, they swept up a bit of a mess. I mean, you know, there are aspects of this budget, you know, and things that Jeremy Hunt has done, you know, things like the sort of zero expensing, the stuff that no one really notices, the fact that they actually chose, with the cuts they've done, that were national insurance, not income tax. Little things that make you think he's at least vaguely aware of the possibility that he could, you know, with a bit of hindsight, be judged as a chancellor who just tried to make it work. Mm. Against the other view, which is, is there anything we can do? The most desperate short-term populist, don't care about the consequences, poison the well, scorched earth move that might just mean that we save a few seats somewhere. Some of our colleagues won't lose their seats. So I think between those two positions, you know, in a sense, I've got the feeling that the sort of the Hunt Treasury, let's not go completely insane, you know, more or less prevailed. But with this compromise position of, we'll cut all the taxes forever. And then the subsequent briefing and the message, like, is this actually a plan? Is this a promise? Is this something we're going to do? Is it just a vague aspiration? That was a function of actually that line not really having been agreed.
We've also seen a fight back over the weekend from Ministers Tom Tugendhat and Anne-Marie Trevelyan, Defence Department, Foreign Office, respectively, pushing for defence spending to go up to 2.5%. And Number 10 saying, it was like a really weird thing because apparently they put this 1,000 word article out on LinkedIn. They say, well, we don't check social media posts, therefore it's okay with cabinet accountability.
That makes no sense at all. That's never been a thing.
None,
right? That makes no sense at all.
I mean, have Number 10 now lost grip.
Yeah, that's what that tells you. That is that essentially there is an argument now about the future of the Conservative Party, what ought to be done. You know, Rishi Sunak doesn't have Sunakites who will just be loyal to him because of who he is and because that they owe their careers to him or anything like that. So I think there are a lot of Conservative MPs who, you know, will want to protect him and defend him to the extent that they don't want, the what was formerly the Lee Anderson tendency and those bits of the Conservative Party that are Andersonite to completely destroy him, and they don't want to replace him.
Andersonite, let's not create
sort of
that.
Word, is it? You know what I mean?
If we go yeah. with Trussite, everything else is doable.
So I think, Rishi Sunak's position in the Conservative Party is entirely a function of recognising that he's all there is and he's the bullock you've got, but that doesn't actually reflect any sort of common sense of belief. And on the specific point about defence spending, I mean, the actual question there is who's going to plug the gap in NATO if you get Donald Trump presidency and the Americans actually make good their isolationist policy to basically abandon continental Europe and Europe in interests. So they are, I think, saying, let's have some of the hard conversations because someone's going to have them.
Yeah. Roz, it does strike me. I mean, the Tories' strong areas traditionally, right, have been defence, crime, looking after older voters. And this budget pivots away from that, every single area of that. Is it an attempt by Hunt to create some sort of legacy, like Raff suggests? Is it actually a miscalculation?
I think it's both.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Want to have my cake and eat it? No, it's both, because the overwhelming thing about this budget is that it completely ignores the crisis in public services. Yeah. Right. It's as if it doesn't exist, as if councils aren't being going bust, as if the NHS isn't in such massive trouble, as if schools and all kinds of public services and courts and prisons aren't crying out for money. That is all just completely ignored. It is swept away. And what we have instead is the kind of budget that you might get if public services were just ticking along great and you wanted to win back some middle-income younger voters. So as we were saying earlier, you know, the NI cut doesn't do anything for pensioners. It's purely for working people. Yeah. The messing around with the family benefit stuff wasn't worth their while to get child benefit because of the complexity of the tax system. And so fixing those things is at once sensible and pragmatic.
Yeah.
And also just, as I was saying, ignoring the enormous elephant in the room, which is so, you know, it's like 10 elephants in the room. But it's nonetheless can be seen to be rewarding the kind of individual striving that is a very Thatcherite version of conservatism. And so it is a very, very curious budget for that reason.
Does it change your expectations at all around an election date? Any of you, actually? I mean,
they're already talking about the next fiscal statement.
I know, those Rube Goldberg machines where a ball rolls and then it knocks a domino, which, you know, cuts a string and inflates a balloon, and you know anyone adult can just go to the end of that contraption and see, oh, there it is, an egg is going to go into a frying pan.
Yeah.
Do we really have to wait for them to stumble from reset event to speech to reset event?
I mean, my hunch initially was like, well, maybe we're looking at May now, but it is really too late. We'd know if it was going to be May, I think.
26th March, apparently, is the latest.
It's still just about possible, and it would be the more sensible thing for Rishi Sunak to do because, as I mentioned earlier, I think there's a strong possibility that the polls could get even worse for the Conservatives, as they are at the moment. But Sunak clearly still feels driven. He still feels there are things he can do. You know, he's only had 16 months in office. That's not very long. Quite a long time for a Conservative leader in recent times, but still not very long. And I think he sincerely believes that he can somehow make the Conservative Party more like the Conservative Party used to be before this autumn.
Yeah, I'm torn on this because, you know, the wish is father to the thought, right? You know, I have lots of motivated reasoning for believing that there will be one in May because I want the election to be soon, for exactly the reason you say. So this country needs an election. But often the simplest explanation that goes to the heart of kind of political vanity is the best one, then that is that Rishi Sunak would rather be a prime minister who served 2 years than one who served 16 months.
I mean, my only counter argument to that is that I think there is a kind of electoral vexation element that they must be aware of, right? Where when people have decided you need to go, just inflicting yourself on them an extra 6 months will just make them want to kick you out even harder. It might actually result in them losing loads of extra
seats. And particularly if the locals that are due in May are so calamitous. First of all, you've lost a load of your councillors who you would actually ideally like to have campaigning for you. But also that could be a factor tipping more Tory MPs in towards reform, or making people think actually reform are the real challenger here. That could be a real accelerant of Tory decline. So maybe actually rip off the plaster in May rather than let the May elections, local elections, feed more sort of disastrous narrative.
If it goes all the way till October, there is a much more likely chance, if possible, maybe we'll say, rather than likely, of them not being the opposition party anymore.
Well, one nerdy point that has been raised, I don't know entirely how significant this is or even how true it is, but it's worth mentioning, which is that actually what Labour MPs will say is that the advantage for them of going long is because they do have a ground organisation. Their contact rate builds up and up, and they get to find out more and more where their voters are. And so the longer Rishi Sunak waits, when he doesn't have any kind of ground operation and all his campaigners are completely demoralised, actually
is an advantage for
Labour. It just means they are ready for the push on the day, and that is a big factor in elections.
Stealing Labour's policies, Hannah, it creates an even bigger gap in its already quite scanned platform. But what is the incentive for announcing anything now? I mean, if there's going to be another fiscal event in the autumn, if you announce anything good, they'll just nick it to do the same thing, to put you in a difficult position.
Well, I think that's exactly why we have heard so little. And, you know, we've had Reeves all over the news giving her response, but her response hasn't included any detail other than I won't bail out councils, or I won't do this, I won't do that, but no detail about what she will do, really. And, you know, they've been burned by the childcare situation, where they were planning this set of policies on childcare from age 12 months. Mm. And then last year in 2023, you know, Sunak came out and one-upped them with an offer from 9 months, albeit it's not.
Having done, though, none of the groundwork.
None of the groundwork. And that's why it's been a
failure. It
was just a
brittle thing. Yeah. They just nipped the headline.
Yeah.
There was nothing underneath.
So they've been burned by that experience, because they had actually done that groundwork. So in my view, they're quite right now to keep quiet until they're actually publishing a manifesto and going out all guns blazing on a campaign. Because, as you say, you know, if they leave the vacuum open so that, you know, they can fill it later, then it looks like they're actually...
Yeah, the vacuum isn't policy. It never has been, I think, for the opposition, and never really is, for exactly the reasons that Hannah describes. The vacuum is having a leader with the charismatic evangelical capability to win arguments without using detail and to tell stories and parables that win the arguments without having to sort of have a policy as the instruments that you do it. And that's just that's proper, you know, upper tier, top level Premier League, that's, you know, your European Champions League level politics. It's hard. Not many people can do it. And Keir Starmer's not a bad politician, but he's not Champions League winning at that level. He's not good enough.
The flip side of that, though, is what's happened with the child benefit thing. So that was if you call it a rabbit out of the hat, where you know, they've made this promise. The thing they've done in the short term is good, which is moving up the threshold so that you're on a higher income before you pay it. But the complicated issue, the real unfairness to it, is that if you choose to have one parent staying at home and one parent working, it's claimed only on one person's salary. So you could earn £60,000or £62,000on one salary and lose a bit of your child benefit. Yeah, yeah. But if two people are earning 48...
They've ironed that kink.
No, they haven't. They have promised to iron out that kink in 2026. And to do that, they have to do something which is very complicated, which is basically combine household tax affairs again. Now, feminist campaigners, obviously, for decades, for generations, were campaigning against this because it's the key method of financial abuse by men over women. And So the fact that household finances are not seen as one entity is a great thing for women. Now, the only way you can actually solve the unfairness is to combine them again, which they have said they're going to do. And now they've created a trap for Labour because Labour aren't going to want to do that. Mm. There is one way out of that, which is to basically make child benefit universal again, yeah, so which again, is exactly what you should do. But again, this is the problem. If you go on and on, you do create that vacuum, then they're going to announce things that they know they're never going to have to implement, which sound good. Mm. So the 2026, we will do this by 2026, is a trap. They know they're not going to be in government in 2026.
Mm. Rose, the weekend and week after a successful budget in an election year, I would say government should be crowing, trumpeting the stuff they've put in there. And instead, it seems determined to change the subject and move the agenda to extremism. Do you think their failure to make any policy program actually stick will push the country inexorably into a culture wars election?
I hope not. I don't think it actually will. It's a strange debate to want to get into at this point, but then Sunak did give that very
weird
speech outside Downing Street, and clearly something had to come out of that speech. He had to then do something, and Michael Gove has been dispatched to do something because Michael Gove gets the tough jobs. But the extremism debate doesn't actually map onto the culture wars very easily. You might think it does, but we saw that with the intervention of Priti Patel in the last day or two, when she's been warning about Michael Gove's proposals and saying that they're potentially going to create problems. And that's because shutting down free speech does have the potential to annoy both the left and the right. It's a cross-cutting issue. And we've seen in the US with the tensions over pro-Palestinian protests and anti-Semitism and so on. If Michael Gove had ever been Home Secretary, he might have realised perhaps how hard it is going to be to start to define extremism. I mean, it's quite possible, although it doesn't seem to have occurred to people, that the pro-Palestinian protests that we're seeing pretty much every week in London are actually acting as a pressure valve, not acting as an incubator for anti-Semitism or even anger over Israel, but a release valve that stops perhaps worse things happening. But the Tories now have a mindset where they believe that protest is tantamount to insurrection.
Depending on what kind of protest. If you're farmers.
Yes. I mean, that's different. But they've spent several years passing laws, which I agree they do not use in the case of farmers going slow on Kent roads, which they used to crack down.
That might
down
just be
very
the potholes slowing everyone down.
Yeah, heavily on protesters. So if you crack down on protests and you police civil society very, very hard, which seems to be the essence of Gove's proposals, then you do risk intensifying anger. And so it's a very risky place to get into.
David Cameron is now Foreign Secretary. Liz Truss is just back from freelancing in the US. Johnson is freelancing in Venezuela. I mean, we could spend a whole episode on that weird episode. Theresa May has announced she's stepping down. She's in the headlines this week. Do you think the churn of recent years simply has created too many Downing Street ghosts for any PM to...
I think this is an interesting one because in a weird way, that kind of revolving door has been a bit of a gift because it allows Sunak to talk about my new administration and all this kind of idea that he's a refresher.
No one's buying it, though.
No. But the flip side of that is that now he's had that period of new administration. He's done absolutely nothing with it except wither away what support the Conservatives had. And now it's all coming back to bite because there's so many out there snapping at his heels.
I love Jeremy Hunt on Sunday going, well, that's the situation I inherited. Those were the decisions that were made. And I was like, what? Literally, your Prime Minister was Chancellor for 3 years before you. So we've reached the end of the show. It's time for escape routes. What non-political staycations have we been engaging in to avoid politics during our downtime? Roz?
I've been watching a BBC series called Borders. Not always very subtle, but it's fun. It's about six black kids who are sent on a scholarship to a posh boarding school and what happens to them. There's some nice satire on equality, diversity and inclusion and how it can end up going a bit wrong sometimes. And it's just very well. The young actors themselves are really, really good as well.
So, far from me to mention another podcast, but I'm going to. It's not a political one, so it's not a direct rival. I've been listening to Kathy Burke's Where There's a Will, There's a Wake, which is a podcast about death. In this country, we don't find death very funny. We don't address it very often. We hide it away. And it's just a brilliant, very funny way of thinking about all of our own mortality. Mm. And I highly recommend it.
Love Kathy Burke. Raphael.
Well, I spent the weekend at York Literature Festival talking about politics, so I actually haven't had that much non-political downtime. But I was actually going to say Borders, because I've also been watching it. So can I just row in behind Ross and say that I agree? I was braced to not like it, thinking this isn't going to work, it's going to be really clunky, they're going to call it wrong, the class nuances will be wrong. And it's not perfect, but actually it's good. It's very entertaining.
And I, as I always do, will recommend a very good horror to our listeners.
You haven't
as
won
I
me
do
over yet.
Every week. Pet on Netflix is really good fun. It sort of has some genuinely head-flipping twists in it where you think one thing is going on and then something entirely different is going on. So I enjoyed that immensely. And that's the end of the Tuesday edition of Very Good What Now. Thank you, Hannah Fern.
Thank you.
Thank you, Raphael Baer.
Thank you.
And thank you, Rose Taylor.
Thank you.
Oh God, What Now? We'll be back on Thursday for our backers and Friday morning for everyone else. So give us £3 and stop being everyone else. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Oh God, What Now? Was presented by Alex Andre, with Roz Taylor, Raphael Baer and Hannah Fern. It was produced by Chris Jones, with audio production by Robin Lieber, video production by Kieran Leslie, and art by Jim Parrott. Managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and Oh God, What Now? Is a Podmasters production.